Hi, welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood from DrAgnar.com and Chloe Archard from PaleoBritain.co.uk. This is now our fifth episode, and we're going to talk around some ideas to do with paleo as it's seen now and as it has been seen historically. So, as usual, Chloe will be in charge of some questions, and we'll start a discussion from there.
Okay, brilliant. Hi, everyone. So this week we thought we'd discuss some of the points that Tommy covered in a recent article that he wrote on his blog. The article was called Going Back to Go Forwards. And he discussed, it was quite a long article. You discussed lots of things, didn't you?
Yeah.
So I'll just kind of briefly sort of go over what we're going to talk about today. So one of the things you said was sort of the paleo diet and lifestyle is growing in popularity, but as it attracts more media attention, it just seems to be coming under attack. And there's obviously various reasons why that's happening. Some of the reasons, I think, is because it's being completely misrepresented. And some of the things are people with other agendas who are just trying to discredit it completely because they don't want it to grow in popularity. But that's kind of a whole different discussion. It was recently branded by the British Dietetic Association as one of the worst diets you could follow in 2015, which is just completely ridiculous. They compared it to a diet where you drink your own urine, for example. So we thought it'd be interesting to talk about how the original paleo diet, as described by Eaton and Connor, differs from what the popular media think paleo is. We also are going to talk about where paleo does have things wrong, and what we can learn from some other kind of not diets, but sort of things that people follow. So one of the things is the Weston A. Price Foundation, and also some of the research that was carried out on people that live in the blue zones, and why dietary dogma is mostly pointless. Tommy posted his article on Facebook, and then there was quite a lot of interesting discussion on there. So first of all, a criticism that came up was that paleo is really unaccessible because of cost, where people can't afford to eat this type of food, and also time and education, and just that, you know, the people that probably need some of this information the most are not the kind of people that are reading and absorbing this information, and that almost it's too complicated telling people all these different scientific things, which I think, Tommy, you completely agree with that, and so do I. And while we both do love the science behind paleo, or just behind nutrition in general, we do want to try and make it simple for people at the same time.
Absolutely.
And we sort of discussed that it doesn't need to be confusing, and that there are some really simple messages that just apply to everybody. So what are those just really straightforward things? They just apply to everybody and it doesn't need to be complicated.
So I think the real broad benefits that come from the kind of general paleo thinking, and these have developed over time and have maybe sort of been fleshed out more recently, but I think the real benefits come from not eating processed food and then replacing that with real food, you know, not eating food with ingredients, but just eating ingredients. And then the stuff on the side that people don't think about, you know, they just focus on the diet and then they don't make sure they're sleeping properly. They don't make sure they're modifying stress. They don't make sure they're starting to move more, walk, you know, go to the gym. You know, the things we talked about before, Chet and I talked on the podcast before, people sort of ignore that.
Just sitting less.
Yeah, just sitting less. I mean, that will reduce your mortality significantly if you just make sure you're sitting fewer than 8 hours a day. So that's the kind of stuff that people don't tend to talk about.
So it really doesn't need to be complicated. We like to talk about kind of all the complicated side of things as well, but it doesn't need to be complicated. And if people just want to tell other people sort of, roughly what their diet involves or their lifestyle involves, it is just those things, isn't it? It's don't eat processed food. Try and eat food that's just simple ingredients that you just cook yourself and those other things you mentioned.
Yeah.
And in your article, you mentioned that people will generally see the biggest results just by cutting out processed food, and particularly just cutting out all refined sugar and refined wheat products.
Yeah.
Would that always be the first thing that you would recommend to people?
Absolutely. I think if you can start replacing processed convenience foods with things that you've cooked yourself, fresh vegetables, fresh meat, eggs, you know, and maybe sometimes that will include, you know, beans or whole barley or something that's not necessarily as part of, you know, a traditional paleo structure. And we can talk about that later. But just that move from processed foods to real whole foods, I think, is where people see most of the benefit. And there's a number of reasons for that. So the first one, processed carbs, processed carbohydrates. We know now, we're starting to see that in terms of our cardiovascular risk, particularly processed carbohydrates affect certain markers in our blood that then predict cardiovascular disease. And I was actually recently at a conference in America where we talked about some hugely complicated lipid tests and very advanced stuff that they're doing over there. And we just don't have access to that stuff in the UK. But simple things from your cholesterol tests, like your triglycerides or your HDL and the ratio between those two, they are indicative of a slightly or a worse pattern of lipids within your blood, which then increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. And you can positively affect that just by removing processed carbohydrate. And then, you know, often what comes with processed carbs is processed fats, and that they can be both animal fats or plant fats. But what happens when they're sort of processed to a high degree, particularly under high temperature, is you will oxidize or damage the fats that are in the food. So particularly polyunsaturated fatty acids, so they're like omega-6 fats that you get from vegetable oils. When they're highly processed and heated, they have a huge ability to generate inflammation. But then, you know, we talk about animal fats a lot in the paleo community, and they're incredibly beneficial. But again, if they're treated to at a high temperature and they're highly processed, they contain cholesterol, which is then oxidized, and then that can cause problems as well. And then when you combine carbohydrates and fat, particularly when they're in that sort of highly processed state, and then you add something like salt, you generate these hyperpalatable foods, which essentially trick the brain into making you eat more. So then they can cause you to overeat. So that's where we know that from animal studies particularly, and from some human studies, that if you make people just eat fat, they don't overeat. And if you make them eat, you know, even just sugar, they don't overeat. But you combine the two, and that's really killer. So like cheesecake is the
perfect example. There was a terrible program on it that you actually blogged about, and I can't remember now the name of the program.
It was Horizon, Fat versus Sugar.
And although the program on the whole had like loads of flaws in it, they did take those two identical twins, didn't they? And one just ate loads of fat and one ate loads of sugar. And they talked there about the fact that actually the problem comes when you combine the two in a processed food.
Yeah.
Because in nature, you don't get foods that are like 50% fat, 50% sugar. They just don't exist.
No, absolutely.
So if you combine them in a factory and make a processed food, it becomes, like you say, it's super tasty, you overeat it. And that's where so much of the problem lies.
And if we think about the foods that we, you know, ate until very recently, you know, if you were eating fat, it usually came from an animal source. And if it came from an animal, there would be some protein included. There'll probably, you know, be some connective tissue or some other stuff included. And if you were eating carbohydrate, it would come, you know, generally from a plant source, and then it would, you know, there'd be loads of fiber and stuff associated with it as well. So we've kind of taken out all those things that change the way we digest it, particularly slow down the way we digest it and change the way we metabolize things, and we've kind of concentrated them down. So I think a lot of processed foods also don't have very much protein, and a deficiency of protein is definitely something we've seen in people eating a Western diet, and that can be corrected by eating whole foods. And then finally, when you're sort of packaging all this stuff and you're microwaving, you know, ready-made meals in plastic packaging, you know, there's a huge number of various toxins and things associated with plastics and processing that we're only just starting to figure out the potential that the damage that they could have on the body. And maybe we're overstating that currently because the state of the evidence isn't that high. But, you know, I think minimizing your exposure to anything like that will also be a benefit, because some of those things found in like plastics and stuff can potentially increase your risk of certain cancers or diabetes or obesity. So all of those things together, removing processed carbs and fats, you know, increasing protein, and stopping sort of those sort of things that trick the brain into eating more, altogether, I think that's why swapping processed foods for whole foods is probably the best change that people can make.
There's a really interesting bit in Zoe Harcoon's book, which is called The Obesity Epidemic. I can't remember the strapline, like how we got here, how we can reverse it or something. But she talks about this whole thing in Whole Foods, and that there's no food in nature, apart from avocados, that has protein, fat and carbohydrate. She says that those kind of foods don't exist in nature, and avocados were the only example that she could find where you do get protein, carbohydrate and fat all in one food. And like you said, most of the time animal foods are protein and fat without carbohydrates, and plant foods have got the carbohydrates and don't really have the protein and the fats. Or sometimes
unless you're talking,
fat, not really the protein.
Yeah, some nuts and seeds are obviously have a combination of the three.
Yeah, I can't remember what exactly she says in the book. I'd have to look back at it. But there was a specific thing she says about avocados. It might be saturated. Although avocados don't have much saturated fat. But there's a thing she says in the book about the fact that in nature you don't find these types of foods. So it's always these processed foods. They are completely unnatural.
Yeah.
And they're not what our bodies kind of used to or recognises. So I think that is a really big one of the main problems. And one of the things is that one of the things you were talking about in the article is like all this argument that goes on about different diets. And you will hear people really defending paleo if that's worked for them, or a plant-based diet if that's worked for them, or whatever it is. And people get so passionate about what's worked for them. So if somebody has decided, I'm going to take up a completely plant-based diet and I'm going to not eat any meat, any dairy, any gluten, but they might eat other grains or whatever, and they feel fantastic on that, they will put it down to the fact that it's a vegan diet, and they will say everybody should be eating a vegan diet. But actually, probably the results they've seen is because they've cut out processed food.
No, absolutely. And there's a lot of people who start out, and you see them, I met a great doctor over the weekend, and he used to be a very passionate vegan. And he felt great for a long time until that started to slip, and then that's when he moved to paleo and found a better balance. So I think people feel really good on a vegan diet or a plant-based diet to begin with, and that's probably because they've cut out a lot of the other processed nonsense, and they've moved more towards whole foods. And then I think later on you can develop problems with various nutrient deficiencies or something like that. But it takes time for that to develop, and in the meantime you feel much better.
Yeah, exactly. And like people will say, it's because I've cut out meat and dairy that I feel so great, therefore everyone should cut out meat and dairy. And they don't realise that actually a lot of the things they're seeing is because they've cut out processed food, not because they've cut out meat.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so if we start at the beginning of how the sort of paleo diet came about, you mentioned Eaton and Connor in your article. Can you tell people a bit more about them and their research?
Yeah, so they, in 1985, they published an article called Paleolithic Nutrition in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is like one of the most, if not the most, well-respected medical journal. And they're both medical doctors. So Melvin Connor is, he's a professor of a number of things, including anthropology. And Stanley Boyd Eaton is still, I think even though he's in his 70s now, a radiologist. They're both from Georgia in the States. And what they did is they basically decided or started with the thought process that we've developed all these new modern diseases. And what's changed, one of the things that's changed dramatically is our diet. So they went back and they looked through the whole of human evolution from, you know, literally millions of years ago. And then they tried as best they could to estimate what various populations were eating. And obviously that varied a lot from, you know, 20% plant and 80% animal foods all the way through to the other end of the spectrum. But then they took more modern hunter-gatherer populations and like the Inuit, but also a lot of tribes in Africa, and kind of tried to equate the diets that we think we had as we evolved with more modern diets, and then look at the structure and components of those from like a macronutrient and a micronutrient composition. And what they actually came up with is very interesting, because it has around, they on average, So about 35% carbohydrate, although it could be up to 50 or 60% carbohydrate, about 35% fat and about 30% protein, which is probably very different from what some people are eating as a paleo diet nowadays. But more importantly than that, they promoted a low saturated fat intake, and that was because animal fat traditionally, and wild animal fat, is very low in saturated fat. So they said less than 10% of energy should come from saturated fat. It was low sodium because there's not much salt in sort of unprocessed wild foods. Like I said, it was relatively high carb potentially, but there was a good calcium intake, most of that coming from plants rather than from dairy or animal products. And they actually talk about it being a very alkaline diet. And you know, we've kind of decided that that's been fairly debunked, like the acid alkaline balance. But even back then, they were talking about the alkalinity of the diet. So it kind of started off life as something that's very different from what we talk about today. And they even included things like legumes, because you know, all these seeds and pods that you can find underground, that like beans and things like that, they were something that have been part of the diet for hundreds of thousands of years. So that's something that actually got removed later on.
There's something again in the Western Price's book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, which I can't remember off the top of my head. I'd have to go back and look at. But he talks about acid alkaline, and there's something in there where he says an acid-forming diet, when it's metabolized, is not the same as like actually making acid in your body. So he looks at the diets, obviously, of all the traditional people, and they did eat lots of meat, and therefore their diet would be considered an acidic diet under this sort of faddy alkaline diet that you hear about again in the popular media. But he says when you actually look at what that turns into in the body, it's not the same thing. But I'd have to look at that again. I can't remember
I can't remember what he wrote, but the way that people look at an acid and alkaline is basically via two potential mechanisms. So one is you take the food and you just burn it until it's ash, and then if you mix that ash with water, it will have an acidity, or it will have a pH. And the things that are thought to be acidic foods tend to be very acidic because of the various minerals that are in there, and the alkaline foods, mainly plant-based foods, are more alkaline. But then also foods, when you eat them, they change the acidity of your urine. It's something called the potential renal acid load. And again, you see something quite similar. But you know, if your kidneys are working properly, they're there to keep your pH balanced. And unless you have any kidney issues, I think we've seen no robust evidence that an acid versus an alkaline diet has any particular effect on disease.
And just while we're talking about it, so again, it does tend to be on vegan blogs. I see people saying, like, you know, if you eat meat and dairy, it will acidify your body. If you eat all these alkaline plant-based foods, your blood will be more alkaline. That is a load of nonsense, isn't it?
Absolutely, because the kidneys respond very, very quickly to that kind of stuff. That's pretty much what they're there for, is acid base regulation, we call it. And I think the reason why so many people have seen benefit on something like an alkaline diet is, again, you know, we're moving away from processed foods and we're moving towards real whole foods. And that's where, you know, I think that's where the real key is. So you can say this is an alkaline diet and it has all these benefits. And I completely agree. Alkaline diets do tend to be very beneficial, but I don't think it's to do with the pH.
And that is what's so frustrating. And I think that's what's been coming out a lot about nutrition, is that it's so frustrating because people sell these theories to sell books about why the diet's working. And it's like all the intermittent fasting stuff that's really popular, the 5-2 diet, vegan, all these things, they're really popular. But on the whole, people are not saying, like, these diets work because you're cutting out processed food. They're coming up with these ridiculous reasons why these diets work. And I think that's what's just so confusing for people, because they read one book that says this diet works because you're cutting out meat, which is causing your body to be acidic. This diet's working because of whatever. And I think that, you know, I think that's why it is important to just give that message to people that actually this is about cutting out processed food to make yourselves healthier. It doesn't really matter what approach you take. And actually, because we're all so different, we can all thrive on different macronutrient ratios.
And people, you know, experts in the fields are still arguing about why certain diets and dietary changes have the effects that they do. So while we're waiting for those people to, you know, slug it out, you know, the answer is still eat less processed foods and eat more real food. So, you know, I think that the reason is actually not that important for you know, the average person.
Exactly. So we talked about like that kind of initial paleo diet that you just said that was described. And one of the problems is that that is never what's portrayed in the media. So people are hearing like paleo is the worst diet you could ever follow. The way it's portrayed in the media, it tends to be, you know, a picture of somebody eating a massive raw steak.
The Daily Mail has that picture of that woman eating a raw T-bone steak, and they wheel it out every time they talk about the paleo diet. It's the same picture. I see it again and again and again.
Exactly. So the way it's portrayed in the media, and the way actually some people do follow it, is a lot of meat and a low-carb diet, and then the fat tends to kind of vary. But what's the problem with that if you do just follow it? It's kind of really high meat, probably loads of fried steak and stuff, very low carb. Why might you not see health benefits if you take that up?
Well, it's difficult. It's sort of when people are talking about, so when they've been sort of telling us about how terrible the paleo diet is, one of the things that they focus on is that it's hard. It's hard to do. So, you know, it's hard to only eat meat and vegetables and eggs and fish. And I do appreciate that that's the case in the modern world where, you know, we're busy, we're stressed, convenience foods are very easily available, and they all contain things that you're not supposed to eat on a paleo diet. But, you know, I think at some point people have to start, you know, you're going to have to start working to look after your health, because in the long term, it's really worth the benefit. And nothing that's worth doing is easy, really, you know. And at some point, I think people have to, you know, start taking control of their health, because, you know, in the UK, as you know, our rates of diabetes and obesity increase, and, you know, the NHS starts to fall apart, then, you know, at some point we have to take some responsibility for our own health. And I think sometimes it's going to be hard, but then it's absolutely worth it. But the way that people portray it is a sort of very high meat, very low carb. Sometimes they talk about vegetables, and I don't really think that that's what a lot of people are eating. So a lot of people are going for a low carb approach, which I think can be really beneficial. We've talked about it before, can be really beneficial, especially for people who have previous metabolic problems like obesity or diabetes. And obviously you can restrict even further and go to a ketogenic diet. And we've talked about that a lot before, and there are some benefits there, but nowadays we talk about a moderate protein intake. So it's not that high protein, and actually we're upping fats as an energy source. And most of it isn't coming from things like steak or bacon, which is how it's often portrayed. But again, it doesn't necessarily need to be like that. If you're interested in like a traditional type paleo diet, which is the paleo diet that they're using in modern trials, you know, we often talk about the fact that the paleo diet has beaten another diet in a trial. So one was versus the Mediterranean diet. This was run by Staffan Lindeberg, who's a researcher in Sweden, and he tried paleo diet versus Mediterranean diet, and what people ended up eating was about 30% carbs, 24% protein, almost 40% fat. And they were actually, you know, they ate some grains and they ate some dairy. They even ate, you know, on his version, it's lean meat, much like how Melvin and Connor originally described it. Not Melvin and Connor, sorry, Eaton and Connor originally described it. So it's lean meat. And they had some legumes and even potatoes were allowed, because that's something that they thought was okay. And they saw, you know, a reduction, particularly in waist circumference, is what they measured, and they thought that was better. But that's not the paleo diet that many people are eating, but that's the paleo diet that we're promoting in trials, and that's the paleo diet that we've seen some benefit with. And that's still relatively high carbohydrate, and actually sometimes includes some of those foods that we think we should be avoiding. So it's a hugely heterogeneous population of diets, and the diets that, yeah. So I mean, the point is that what was originally described and what's used in trials is very rarely what people are actually eating out in the real world. And I'm not saying that one is necessarily better than the other, but it's just the fact that there's a huge discrepancy between the two that's very interesting.
But also, like, back to the whole vegan thing, like, who's to say that if you ate 90% plant food and then your other 10% was things like organ meats and lots of liver and some really good quality butter and maybe some cod liver oil and, you know, just things that are going to give you some nutrients, maybe some eggs, and then 90% plants. Who's to say that was all coming from whole foods, that that's going to be worse than, like, 30% protein? You know, like, it's... Because you are still going to get protein from plant foods.
Yeah,
and you know, that's it's actually... just really hard to say, isn't it, that where... Like, I think we'd agree that if you don't eat any animal products, you're going to be missing out on some key nutrients, but there's no real evidence that if you ate largely plant foods with some really nutrient-dense animal products, that you're going to have worse health than somebody that eats more meat.
I think that could work for a lot of people, and that sounds very similar to what Mark Hyman promotes. He calls it his vegan diet.
Which is
paleo vegan, so it's mainly plant-based foods and then some key animal foods to get some various micronutrients and maybe increase, you know, get some fat and some protein. And, you know, there's that could absolutely work for some people, but then on the other end of the scale, the evidence that we actually need vegetables is fairly thin, where they've tried to add vegetables to people's diets, they haven't really had that much of an effect. You know, they've done trials where people have had IBS or, you know, constipation, bloating, and they've removed all fiber from the diet and people have had a resolution of their symptoms. So there's this huge spectrum that we could potentially, that we can potentially cover with these kind of recommendations. And it really comes down to what people find works for them, but it gives them a lot of scope to experiment and work on it. And I think that's what's really good, is it doesn't need to be as restrictive as people really, you know, think it is.
Make it how it needs to be, exactly. And then just talking about the vegetables, there is a really, there's an interesting video that you sent me, we can maybe link to it afterwards that people can have a look at. I think it was, what was it called, Little Shop of Horrors or something?
Oh, yeah, by Georgia Ead.
It's the first time I've actually seen somebody talk about vegetables and say, you know, the evidence is not that strong. And you talked about that again in the article, you sort of alluded to that a little bit, just saying that vegetables are great because they're actually... tasty, and if you eat them instead of some of the more sort of calorific, I know we're not really talking about calories, but sort of calorific carbohydrates, you probably will sort of see benefits again. But actually that talk is saying there's not that much evidence that it's the vegetables themselves that are giving the benefits. Is it just the fact that the vegetables are replacing something else in the diet, like processed carbohydrates?
Absolutely, could be. And you know, I generally promote vegetables because I think there is some good evidence that as part of a generally healthier lifestyle, they do provide some benefit. But if people want robust evidence that everybody should be eating vegetables, that just doesn't exist. And I think, again, that's something that's very interesting to think about.
And many people, again, talking about how sort of paleo was initially described, these dietary patterns, and then how that's sort of changed a little bit and how people follow paleo now, most or many paleo people do still completely avoid dairy, and we have covered that in our first podcast in quite a lot of detail if anyone wants to listen to that. But just briefly here, why is it not necessary? Some people might need to exclude dairy, but why is it not necessary that everyone excludes dairy? And like, again, you talked about that, these trials, and they are having some dairy and they're still seeing benefits. It's not necessary for everybody to completely cut dairy out of their diets.
No, I think so part of it is to do with, so people often talk about lactose and dairy, and you know, in Scandinavian populations, maybe only 1% have a lactose intolerance. But if you go to like non-Caucasian, you know, in Africa or Asia populations, they have 80% or above intolerance to lactose. But then also there's a potential for casein protein to be difficult to break down, particularly if it's A1 versus A2 casein. And some people, you know, have a difficulty digesting that, and that can give them some gut symptoms like bloating or, you know, diarrhea potentially. But you know, if people are eating dairy and they're not getting any issues with it, which I think is a good proportion of people, you know, around 3,000 years ago, we think we started to adapt to greater dairy in the diet. And then, you know, certain fats, some good saturated fat, if you're getting your dairy from a grass-fed source, then things like CLA, vitamin K2, there's some vitamin D, and you know, I don't believe that we need dairy for our calcium intake, but you know, sometimes it is beneficial to get some calcium, and dairy is obviously a good source of that. And then also it can be a great source of probiotics, particularly, you know, full fat and fermented dairy, which is where I think the money really is. Cheese and kefir and some yogurts and things like that can be really beneficial there as well.
I personally for a long time I hadn't had that much dairy, but I still always have butter, and I always have kefir because I live near a really nice farm where I can get raw kefir. The cows are all organic, it's grass-fed, blah, blah, blah. And so I was having that like the last year or so, but in December, as typical around Christmas, everything starts to kind of, you know, just eat whatever. And I started having quite a lot of milk to drink in coffees and things like that. I'd go around someone's house and have a cappuccino or whatever. And I developed a cough at the beginning of December that just did not go away. And I had it for the whole of December. And I really like just kind of cold type symptoms, even though I knew I didn't have a cold because I kind of felt all right. Yeah. I had all this congestion. My skin went really terrible. And after Christmas, I thought I'm just going to cut out milk again. And cut out milk at the beginning of January. A couple of days, my skin was completely clear again. And my cough went away. I literally had this cough the whole of December, and I was like, this is not normal, it's not a cold. And I'm sure that was down to milk, but yeah, I can have butter and kefir and stuff like that absolutely fine. So again, with dairy, it's like the like fermented dairy or the high fat dairy is quite different to the milk, and I guess that's just because it does have less protein. So if the protein's what's causing you, and lactose, so if it's either the protein or the lactose that are causing you the problem.
And you know, so and it's also the structure of those will change. So often the lactose is used up, but then, you know, the casein structure will be changed or broken down by the bacteria or fungus that's fermented it. So that I think that's part of it as well.
Yeah. So another thing that you talk about quite a lot is grains and it's called the legumes in America, is an American thing, isn't it? So we would call them beans or pulses.
Pulses, yeah.
So a lot of people say, what do you mean with legumes? Because when I said it to my mum, she's like, legumes means vegetables in French.
So
we're talking about beans and pulses and stuff, like lentils and cannellini beans and kidney beans and stuff in grains. And we can't credibly tell people that everybody should avoid these, because there's plenty of healthy people that have included these in their diets and been absolutely fine. You know, been healthy, eating lots of these. So one thing that interests me is that when I do completely cut out grains and everything, I do feel better for it. I have loads more energy when I don't eat grains. Is that because I probably then replace grains with more nutrient-dense foods, or is it because grains are an issue, but then if grains are an issue, why are there all these people that can eat them without a problem?
So I think there's multiple possible things going on there. So if we talk about, you know, grains and gluten is the one that, you know, from wheat is something that people sort of tend to focus on. But even if you ask Alessio Fasano, who's basically the guy who discovered the fact that gluten or gluten breakdown products can bind to something called zonulin in the gut and increase gut permeability, and it can actually do the same thing with the blood-brain barrier. He only thinks that about 10% of people have some kind of level of gluten sensitivity. And there is some data out there suggesting that it's 30%, but that comes from one company that's doing a stool test for gluten sensitivity. And that's not, you know, a well-established, peer-reviewed kind of data set. So, you know, at the moment, our best experts suggest 10% are allergic to gluten or sensitive to gluten in some way, and they're the people that should avoid it. And for the other people, he doesn't necessarily think that needs to be the case. Four things. So what happens when people go down the road of these kind of exclusion diets? I think most, like we've talked about, most of the benefit comes from just eating better food. You get this huge kind of aura around certain foods that are kind of deemed too bad for us. And they've actually done some really interesting studies where they told people that they were allergic to a food that they weren't allergic to, then fed them that food, and they saw a visible allergic reaction. So like a rash, they felt unwell and said, you know, I feel terrible, I've eaten this food, I'm allergic to it. And they're actually not allergic to it. So there's a huge cognitive component there. And I'm not saying that you're making it up, Chloe, when you feel better when you remove grains from the diet. But I think that for a certain part of this, that's definitely possible, that people have been told that gluten is bad for them, and then they just feel better when they take it out. But actually, there's a huge sort of mind-body connection going on there. And one of the things that people talk about a lot are lectins. So lectins are things that you can find in grains and in pulses, beans, lentils, and they are proteins that can bind to carbohydrates, and they're traditionally there as like a protective factor against insects or things like that, which might prey on the plant. But if you think about, so everybody just says that lectins are therefore bad because, some people think that wheat germ agglutinin, which is one of the major lectins in wheat, can interfere with insulin or leptin receptor signaling. But there isn't actually very much good evidence to suggest that. And if we're talking about lectins as a whole, if you wanted to remove all lectins from your diet, like you couldn't eat sweet potatoes, you couldn't eat garlic, you couldn't eat any berries, and you probably wouldn't be able to drink green tea or eat any chocolate. Dark chocolate also has a number of lectins in it. So I think people kind of associate these things as bad, but the evidence isn't necessarily that strong. And a lot of the lectins, so a big one is phytohemagglutinin, which you get in kidney beans particularly. And I was reading, so we talked about Mark Hyman's pegan diet, and he was talking about why he doesn't necessarily include beans. And when Lauren Cordain talks about why he doesn't include beans in his version of the paleo diet, he links to the same article, which is basically a rat study where they gave rats a whole ton of uncooked kidney beans. And that stuff, that stuff is toxic. We absolutely know that it's toxic. But we also know that, once you've soaked or fermented grains or beans or, any kind of pulse, then, the lectins are pretty much broken down, most of them, not all of them, but most of them are. And in something like kidney beans, there are actually saponins, and we're also told that saponins are bad, but saponins A and B, they act as antihistamines. So they reduce histamine release and can actually be anti-inflammatory in the gut rather than pro-inflammatory, which is what we're told. So it's much more complicated than people talk about. And actually a lot of this stuff, if you prepare the foods properly, isn't really an issue, and they actually become quite healthy.
How many raw kidney beans would you have to eat to kill yourself?
that's a good question. It's not that many. I think if you had a good handful of raw kidney beans, you'd be very, very sick.
So what do you recommend to people listening in that have not eaten grains for 2 or 3 years, been following quite a strict paleo diet, haven't eaten grains, haven't eaten legumes or pulses? If they feel fine and they don't want to introduce them, then fine, obviously don't reintroduce them. But if people are thinking, I maybe do want to include some of these things in my diet, what's your recommendation?
So I think that, that's something that can absolutely be done. But it's not something that people have really looked at. And I've had some conversations with people about how you might go about this. And I would start with lentils, because lentils have the lowest content of things like lectins, but they do have some good resistant starch and stuff, which we know can be good, and that ferments in the gut and produces things that we know are very good for the metabolism. So maybe start with some lentils and start in small doses, and you make sure that they've been properly soaked. So you soak them for 24 to 48 hours, and they're properly cooked. And interestingly, a lot of beans and pulses and things have phytates, we talk about. So phytates are things that can bind to the minerals and stop you absorbing them. But interestingly, most legumes or pulses have phytase as well. So it's something that breaks down the phytate. And if you soak in an acidic culture, so with some lemon juice, or maybe you add some yogurt or kefir or something like that while you soak them, then that will
really get...
Apple cider vinegar, great. And that will get the phytase going. But you shouldn't necessarily be 100% scared of phytates, because actually they seem to increase bone density, and which is counterintuitive, because they could bind the calcium and stop you absorbing it. But we give a class of drugs called bisphosphonates for people who have osteoporosis, and that can help increase bone density basically by preventing the breakdown of bone. And it seems like phytates act in a similar way. So maybe phytates aren't as bad as we initially thought. So again, properly soaked, properly cooked, and then in small doses, so maybe only start with like a tablespoon at a time, and you slowly increase it, and then you could work your way up to some slightly, you know, from lentils to kidney beans. You know, chickpeas are great as well. And I just start slower, and I'm sure because you're probably increasing your resistant starch intake, you know, you might get some extra flatulence and a bit of extra bloating, but that stuff will settle down over time, and you know, maybe then you can enjoy some hummus and stuff that you made, which I think, you know, is all potentially great.
And what about someone that's been gluten-free for a long time? Would you ever suggest, is there any benefit to introducing wheat back into the diet? Like, what are you going to gain by introducing wheat back in?
I don't think there's anything to be gained from introducing wheat in particular. I mean, there's nothing that you need from wheat. For most people, they don't need the carbohydrate. They don't need any of the extra stuff that's in there. So, if somebody wants to slowly reintroduce it, I'd do it in a very similar way. And I'd start with, again, things that have been shown to be beneficial. So you could start with like a whole grain barley, which you soak and cook in a stew or something. So there'll be a small gluten dose, but you know, you'll also get some nice resistant starch, some fiber. And one thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of like whole grains versus refined grains and it goes back to the kind of the anti-nutrient content of whole grains that we're often told about. So when we look at populations, and there was a study that recently came out that showed that if you ate more whole grains, that it made you live longer. And the argument against that study is what they're comparing whole grains to is refined grains. So in people who eat grains, whole grains are better than refined grains. And that's not particularly relevant to the paleo community because they're not eating grains in the first place. So whether that information says we should add in whole grains, I don't think it tells us, and I'm not sure there's any evidence that that will be the case. But it's interesting to think about the fact that if all these anti-nutrients in whole grains are so terrible, how come we see a benefit when we swap whole grains with processed grains? You know, even if you're taking in the same total carbohydrate load, plus you add all those kind of, you know, the bran and all that other stuff from wheat, say, and which has all the stuff that we're told is bad for us, we still see positive metabolic benefits. And that's because some of it will be fermented in the gut to produce things like butyrate. And I think that the things that we're told are bad for us, most of it's theoretical. And if you don't have an issue with it, then I don't really see why you should exclude it from the diet, as long as it's not coming in this sort of like processed kind of package. Because I don't think, if all these things were so bad for us, if we increased whole grain consumption in the diet, we'd see some negative effects, and we just haven't seen that. So there's just an interesting thought experiment that goes on there that maybe some of the stuff that we've been told is bad from things like wheat isn't as bad as we think it is.
And also, like, that kind of ties in nicely with something else we were going to discuss, which is the Western A. Price Foundation and the work of Western Price, which I do absolutely love the book. It's called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, for anyone that hasn't read it. And there's some things about the book that aren't great, and that's just because of the time that it was written. But on the whole, it's a brilliant book. It's so interesting. And Western Price visited traditional societies around the world in the 1920s and 1930s and looked at what the people that ate their kind of native diet and what they'd eaten for hundreds of years were eating and what their health was like, and then what happened to those people when they adopted the foods of modern kind of commerce, which was refined white flour, refined white sugar, lots of jars and cans of food. And he did find plenty of healthy people around the world that ate predominantly dairy or lots and lots of grains. And one of the examples in the books is some people in the
the Outer Hebrides, I think. Yeah.
Where they ate loads of oats. Oats was basically the main food that they sort of survived on, with fish. And they were eating nutrient-dense foods because they ate fish, and they ate the fish heads, and they ate the fish livers, and all of that kind of stuff. But a lot of their nutrition came from oats. And they were, you know, they were healthy, they were robust. And the same thing with dairy. He found people that in Switzerland that ate rye bread, which has obviously got gluten in. And with the rye bread, they had loads of butter and loads of cheese. And that was their diet, really, for most of the year, because where they were, they couldn't grow that many vegetables and things. And he found these people were thriving. So if the human body can thrive on that kind of diet that has that does have lots of grains or lots of dairy, it can't be that bad, because if it was that bad, those people would have suffered massive ill health, but they didn't.
So there's, I mean, there are people will continue to argue that that could be because of specific genetic changes that occurred in those populations, and that's
he visited so many different people. It wasn't like, I've given two examples, but I think in the book he's visited like 60 different societies that have all got their specific diets that are heavy in one type of food or another,
yeah.
And they're not seeing detrimental effects. So it isn't just like the Scottish people eating oats. He found these kind of people that were eating lots of grains or lots of dairy, as well as lots of animal products and things, and actually not that many of them ate loads of vegetables.
No, absolutely. And I think what that ties nicely into it is something else that I mentioned in the article, which is the blue zones, which I think are kind of considered maybe the modern day equivalents of the kind of places that Weston Price looked at. And, you know, there's a book about them, but, you know, I don't really think that you should rely on that. But there are lots of scientific studies that look at these populations as well. And they, you know, depending on where they are, could eat a heart, you know, a legume heavy diet or a grain heavy diet, and they do fine.
And I think not only do fine, they kind of thrive, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
They live more centenarians than anywhere else in the world. Lots of people living healthily into their 90s.
Yeah, and so I think part of the kind of the reason why those places are very important is they kind of challenge the traditional thoughts that we have in the paleo community about how we should eat, and I think it really demonstrates the diverse societies all over the world and throughout history and the different things they've eaten, and some of those things diets have been very heavy in the stuff that we're told we should avoid. And I think that once we've got into a state of ill health, which many people have, then being very restrictive and particularly reducing processed or carbohydrate intake can be very beneficial. But if we're talking about longevity and prevention of disease, then obviously there's a number of diets which people can potentially thrive on. And I think it's important not to get too stressed about eliminating all these different foods that are supposedly bad for us, because I don't think the evidence that they're bad for us is that strong. And then what that kind of the really important thing that falls out of that is are the other things that these people are doing, both the ones that Weston Price went to see around the world and that we're seeing in places like Okinawa or Nicoya in Costa Rica or Icaria in Greece. And these people, you know, they live a very different life to the one that we live, and they're much more active. So that's probably part of the reason why they can tolerate a much larger intake of carbohydrate. And, you know, because they're farming or hiking, and, you know, they all have some kind of stress modification. So, you know, they're either napping or meditating, and they all have these huge sort of very productive communities. So, you know, everybody, you know, the families, or they have a church that they're part of and they spend a lot of time with. And so these people are, you know, up and walking about all day. They spend a lot of time outdoors. They spend a lot of time with their family and friends. They spend a lot of time modifying stress, and they sleep properly. And then what I think is really interesting, once you're doing that, what you're eating doesn't seem to matter quite as much. And so that's where I think we need to be focusing. Obviously, we move towards whole foods, but if you can start to introduce some of those things into your life, that's where I see people gaining a huge amount of benefit, and that's why those societies are very nice to look at, because of those kind of clues that they can give us.
So they do have one big thing in common with the diet, which is that they don't eat processed food.
Absolutely.
And they eat whole food. So that's, again, back to this thing we're saying is really, really important. That's the one thing they do have in common. So if you're going to take anything away from looking at all these different kind of traditional societies or people in the blue zones with extreme longevity, they don't eat processed food. But I think all those other things you've talked about are so important, and I think that people still struggle to get on board with a lot of those. And so are there any kind of, like, what are really good tips that you can give people to just start addressing some of these other things? Because there's lots of people that already are eating a good diet, and just what other things can people do that are kind of easy to implement? Or so, maybe easy to implement, because like you said, some of these things aren't easy, but you have to at some stage take responsibility for your own health.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think actually a lot of the stuff that we've talked about and we've written about individually, and we are writing about, I think moving more is very important. So standing less and walking more. And there was a really nice study that came out today, which basically, I think it was the University of Birmingham. They took some of their sedentary employees and they put them, you know, they had like a control group and an active walking group. And three times a week, they went out as a group and they walked for half an hour. And they all had more energy in the afternoons and they were less stressed. And that's such a simple thing that anybody can do. And it just shows the power of going for a walk with some other people and talking to them. You know, so socializing more, walking more, it has a huge benefit. And again, we're not, you know, reducing the time that we're sitting during the day. And then if you want to move on from there, you know, you're walking more than, you know, 30 minutes a day, five times a week, and then you want to go from there, then maybe you should listen to the podcast where I talk with Chet about other ways to introduce, you know, movement or strength training into your day. And I think that's probably plenty there. And then, you know, there are a huge number of benefits that we've seen from something like meditation, and it matters less exactly the kind of meditation that you do. So if that happens to be, you know, you're doing yoga and box breathing and something like that's a certain type of meditation. Mindfulness, there's hundreds of apps that will run you through a simple 10-minute sort of like mindfulness breathing exercises. And I think those are a great place to start. So the one that I know a lot of people like is something called Headspace. The website is getsomeheadspace.com. And I think you do need to pay eventually, but you know, you can try it out for free and see whether that's something that you like. And then we talk about simply, you know, part of the walking thing is just spending time outdoors, you know, getting into the sunshine. That's how you should be getting your vitamin D. That's how you should be spending a lot of your time. And we're built to be outdoors. And we know that people are more likely to have issues with their mood if they spend a lot of time indoors.
And I was going to say the walking thing as well. Like, one of the reasons walking is so great is because it kind of combines a lot of the things you need to do. Because for a lot of people, if you go for a walk in a lovely, like if you live somewhere where, even if you live in a city, there's usually a lovely park where you can go for a walk. And actually for a lot of people, that is also a little bit of like stress relief as well, because while you're sort of wandering around for half an hour, you do relax and you finish that walk feeling more relaxed. So you get the kind of movement and the stress relief and the being outside in nature all in one go. Whereas like forcing yourself to go to the gym and doing a workout, you maybe get the movement benefit, but if you're not that keen on doing it, you're not getting the stress relief benefit.
Yeah, if you hate it, it won't have the same effect if you're not enjoying it. And then once you've been for your brisk walk with your friends outside, you'll sleep much better, which is the final important thing. And, you know, I think it's really important that people do start to, you know, turn off the computers earlier, turn off the TV earlier. Don't take your iPhone or iPad with you to bed. You know, try and get to sleep, you know, when it's dark, you know, 9 or 10 p.m. Wake up when it gets light. And those kind of circadian rhythm things are also very important. So if you can start to introduce all those things, I think that's where people will see the real benefit. And being active as much as you can during the day, sleeping properly, removing all that processed food and just learning, you know, I think a lot of people have forgotten how to cook, and that's where a lot of problem comes from. And they maybe feel that they don't have time to cook. But there's, you know, there's so many resources out there where people can just start to do some basic stuff and, you know, fry an egg and, you know, chop some cabbage and some onion and make a basic coleslaw, or, you know, it requires really minimal skills and minimal time, and it's cheaper, than buying loads of processed food. So I think somebody mentioned after I posted my article that you can just go and watch some of Jamie Oliver's videos, and he's great, and he's got some really basic tips. And obviously the food that he recommends isn't necessarily what would fit with a paleo diet, but on the whole, it's so much better from what people are generally eating, and even that would be a fantastic start.
Exactly. I am going to write a post soon on eating well on a budget, so I'll share that when I have, but it is, again, it can be expensive to eat food because it just depends on what you buy, but actually it is easy to eat well cheaply because you can do things like Able and Cole in the UK that do a delivery service. They sell chicken carcasses, organic free-range chicken carcasses for £1.50. You get the chicken carcass, I get it every week, it has loads of meat still on the chicken carcass. You get like chicken necks, all the livers and everything in there. So for £1.50, you get this nice little bundle that you can just literally stick into a slow cooker, put some water on top, leave it going all day, and at the end of it, you get a stock, a really nice stock that you can use for soups and stuff, and then you just take the chicken carcass back out and pull all the meat off, and you get like a whole plate of meat of like the bits that have come off the chicken.
Yeah.
And that costs £1.50, and you get livers in there as well, so then you can like turn the liver, if you get it for like a couple of weeks in a row and just freeze the livers, you can then make some liver pate out of the livers that you got, and that's just like a little added extra that you can then have for lunches for a few days. Stews, you can't really go wrong with, and they're super cheap, aren't they? You just buy, you can get organic grass-fed meat, something like shin beef, which is really cheap. You can get it for like £2.99 and put that in your slow cooker again with like some onions, which are cheap, carrots, which are cheap, potatoes, which are cheap, and you know, turn it into a really nice stew. You kind of can't go wrong with it, even if you don't know how to cook.
Yep.
Because if you leave it on all day, it will come out tasty.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great place for people to start.
Okay, brilliant. So I think we're about up to an hour. So
yeah, that's probably about. We've snuck under the hour mark, so let's quit while we're ahead.
Yeah, okay, brilliant. If just like normal, if anyone's got questions and things, just get in touch. We'll post all of this on social media, so just comment on there, or if you've got anything you want to ask, email us, comment on the blogs or...
Yeah, and it'd be we've had some really nice reviews from people on iTunes, so if you feel the same way, it'd be very nice if you would leave one of those and you know, be honest and let us know what you want to hear more of or less of, and you know, that will enable more people to kind of hear this, and we can sort of build a community that's maybe starting to talk about some sensible ways to make everybody healthier.
Okay, brilliant.
Great.
Thanks for listening.
Right, thanks, guys. Bye.